speaker. I went to this year's Texipaw conference, which was hosted in Austin, which was kind of a big deal because I swore I would never go to another Texipaw conference because the last one just left me feeling like I have no place here. I'm not a young person anymore. And so I had no plans on going to the Texipaw conference. They asked me to be of service at the last moment for somebody who couldn't make it. So I said that I would. And I would have missed out on a great experience if I hadn't gone. I can say that. I left that conference feeling like, wow, maybe I do have a place at Texipaw conferences. And one of the things that was most amazing about that weekend was, of course, coming in contact with lots of young people in sobriety who have that level of excitement that I vaguely recall when I had when I came here. It seems a while ago now, so I forget. And so the good thing about interacting with young people in Alcoholics Anonymous is that it reminds me how exciting it is to be young, how exciting it is to have a whole life ahead of you, and how exciting it is to be sober. And there was one particular bright spot at the conference, and that happens to be our speaker tonight. His name's Paul. And he was running here and there and everywhere, and I knew right away that he has this deal. He is excited about being sober, and I asked him how much time he had, and he'll tell you today he has over a year of sobriety. And so I invited him to come, not realizing at the time that he lives in Odessa. And he said he would. And when I remembered how far away he left, I offered him an out, and he said no, he would come. And not to give too much of his story away, but I will tell you that he's had a very difficult week. And I called him last night, and I said, you don't have to come, because I know how challenging your life is today. And you cannot come, and it will be okay. And he said, no, I've made a commitment in AA, and I feel strongly, and my family and my sponsor would have me be there, so I'm coming. And so I picked him up at the airport today. We had a nice talk. We had a nice visit. I know that I love him, and I know by the end of his story you will love him too. Paul R. from Odessa.
I just want to start off by thanking you guys for having me at your fellowship. This place is awesome. And I'm just going to jump right into it. My name is Paul Regan, and I'm from Odessa. Today, ironically, I'm working day 666, which I felt was pretty cool for this being my first time speaking. And I'm just going to jump right into it. Starting off in my early adolescence, in between 4 and 8 years old, I was already having onset behaviors of an alcoholic. Now, see, I'd exceed in schoolwork, but when it came to behavioral things, I was selfish, got in a lot of fights, had a lot of fear. You know, the relationship with the family, the upbringing, it was abusive, sexually, mentally, physically. A typical alcoholic upbringing, at least for me. This is just my story. Now, going on from 9 to 11 is when I took my first drink. I'm not specific on when it was, but I remember what it was, and I remember there wasn't enough of it because I wanted more. And it's funny because I was introduced to it by some older family members, and you know that feeling of your older cousins being, come here, yeah, here, have some of this. And you know, I was the youngest of our generation, and I thought, I have arrived. I'm here. I'm finally accepted. They'll love me more, you know, if I just play along with them. Well, it turns out I didn't really care about playing along with them as soon as I took my first drink. And then an odd thing happened, because even though in that moment of taking my first drink and me wanting more, my disease went dormant for about 3 years. From 12 to 15, I actually was scared of outside issues and alcohol. I call them dry goods. Because I saw my father, who is now unfortunately wet, and he walks the streets of my hometown, and he sleeps under the bridges, and he goes to the food bank, and he gets in contact with me through going through the public library and Facebook messaging me. Now all he sends is stickers, not hellos, you know, just little kind of funny animated stickers. You know, it's kind of like a symbolic way of telling me how he's doing, you know. But today, because of my sobriety, I could love him. And I could be there for him. And I could respond to him with stickers, too. So that's always pretty fun. You know, there's never a dull moment. So 12 to 15, it was kind of like, okay, this stuff could get scary because I would see him pull over the car to vomit, keep driving. I would see him disappear for weeks on end. And, you know, that's it kind of clicked in my mind that there may not be too good of things that come from drugs and alcohol. But from 16 to 18, that's when it really kicked off. That's when the depression kicked in. I went to a Catholic high school. I did not feel accepted at all because I hated church. I hated organized religion. All they did to me was they preached fire and brimstone. I already knew I was going to hell because of how I was brought up. You know, I was such a bad kid. There was no way I was going to be able to make up for it, no matter how many Hail Marys, no matter how many prayers, no matter how much I tried to help other people. I wasn't getting into those pearly gates. And what do kids at a very prominent Catholic high school have? A lot of money. And that was my open channel. Because I got in with the misfits and the outcast. And we said, hey, it's time to party. We don't care about the jocks. We don't care about being valedictorian. It's time to party. This is our high school years. And I ran with it. See, because once I got a little drink of this, or I took a little drink of some white powder, or I took a little drink of a little piece of paper, you know, or took a little drink of some fungus, you know, took a little drink of this little fluffy green plant. Oh, I was the man, you know. You called me, I knew where the party was, you know, and I could get you there. And it was fun, and it was. You know, some people tell me, my worst day sober is better than my best day when I was using. Well, to me, that wasn't true. And it's become a reality over time that I've learned to accept. But that'll be later on. So that was my experience. Now, there was lots of overdoses, things like that, blackouts, things that I feel like don't really need that much attention because we've all been there. We all know what bottom's like, and it got really scary. I mean, it struck fear into me when I finally hit my bottom. And I remember, I just got done hanging out with a buddy, and I was walking down this grassy knoll. And I was 18 years old, just been kicked out of my aunt's house, family structure falling apart. I was barely holding on to my college curriculum. And I was walking down this grassy knoll, and I just heard a voice. My God, he still cusses at me, which I'm happy about. I love when my guy cusses at me. Keeps me entertained, you know. I don't like the real PG God. My God's still pretty rated R. He's pretty hardcore. He likes getting on me. And I just hear this voice, and it says, "What the fuck are you doing?" And that was it. And I called my mom. She had 25 years at the time. I said, "Mom, I'm done. I'm ready to come home." She said, "Okay. You know where I'll be." And I showed up to my original home group's meeting, 7 a.m. that next morning. And that's when I started taking the journey. And for the first 2 weeks, I couldn't talk. I mean, the fog was thick. You go to Stockton, California, and you ask about that young guy, Paul Regan, everyone will have a story about him. Because the lights were on, but no one was home. I remember I'd just sit in those meetings and just bawling my eyes out. And in a split second, I'd be laughing because I'd hear him say the exact same things that I was told when I was younger. And when people saw that they were worried about me and they said, "You might have a problem and here's your solution." But at 16, you don't care about that. You just want to get more off. That's it. You want to escape reality more. You know, because at 16, I was the man. You know, I had a grip on life. I knew where I was going. I was going to the party, you know, and that's just how it was. But being in those rooms and following every single suggestion. I mean, we used to have the wets come in and shoot up in our bathrooms, you know. So, I mean, I was happy to go clean up after them, take showers in there. It was awesome because I felt for the first time in my life that I was helping a greater cause than me. That I wasn't selfish anymore. I loved taking out the trash. I loved being of just... I started off with minimal service, and I started working my way up, wiping down tables. That's all it took, and it got me happy because I was able to sit around with the old-timers and get their knowledge, and figure out how do I conquer this disease called alcoholism. And they told me, you can't conquer it. You could treat it, but you're never going to win. I said, okay. That was something I was able to accept because I didn't want to die. Like, whatever you say, I'll do it. And so about a month in, the fog had lifted just enough for me to become coherent. And I had various people take me through the steps. And this is funny also. I actually had three sponsors at one point in time because they weren't giving me the information I wanted fast enough. I wanted to get these 12 steps done knocked out when they wanted me to think about them. I said, no, no, no. I was like, my thinking's not good. I just need to get these done. I need some relief. And they all took their time with me, and they're all very patient and loving. And I actually had one man, we were driving in his car one day, and he said, you know your ABCs. I was like, what do you mean? I was like, of course. I was like, you know, that's kindergarten. He said, no, your ABCs, steps 1, 2, and 3. I said, no. He said, you practice those every day. See, because now, even though I'm still powerless over alcohol, I'm powerless over people's effect on me, places' effects on me, and feelings' effects on me. I can't control those outside things, but I could control my response. See, because back when I was using, it wasn't a response, it was a reaction. It was like that. Now I could actually think, I have the clarity. So every morning when I hit my knees, I do that 1, 2, and 3. I do my ABCs. Because some days I may wake up and I'd be batshit crazy. You know, K-Fuck Radio is playing loud and clear, and I don't want to go to work, you know. And so I gotta sit there, and I got to ask to be restored back to sanity, you know, and I got to turn my will over. Because sometimes that ego, just in the little bit of sobriety I have, will try and take back over. Those reservations will try and keep back in. Because I live a full life now. I got blessed with an awesome job. I'm a student. Sometimes those voices will come on, hey, you got it back. Dude, you're 20. What are you doing? You didn't even start. You know, I got to pray and I got to get rid of that bullshit. Because I don't have another one in me. I came in dying. I mean, I was 180 pounds. I was looking good. I mean, the stomach was flat, but the jaw was thin. So I thought I looked good, but really I wasn't that good. Now I weigh a healthy 250 pounds, you know, and that's all. That's another benefit of the program, too. You get healthy in here. You eat. So I do my 1, 2, 3 every day. And what really laid the foundation was that 4-step. There's a lot of emphasis on that and a lot of emphasis that I learned that that's the step. That's the step that separates a lot of people. And like I said, I took every suggestion because I was dying. I mean, I was dying physically, emotionally, mentally. I was dying. So I got with a sponsor, and we started working on that 4-step. And I realized that every reaction I had to every situation rooted back to fear. I realized, okay, I'm scared, and I'm weak. And my response, all these negative responses have rooted from that. And I said, you know, maybe it's time to let it go. That's when we did the 5th step. And man, that 5th step, I'm telling you, that first honest 5th step, whoo, there's so much crying and snot flying, and I got done, and that euphoria, that little symphony came on. And I was like, wow, you know, I had let go of a guilty conscience. I was thinking clearly now. I'd let go of my past. I cleared that wreckage, and it felt amazing, and I was ready to go on, and it was beautiful. And then that's when I actually got the call from my uncle to maybe start a new life in Texas. And I was thinking about going to the Navy. I just got done with MEPS, took my test and everything, probably a couple weeks away from signing off on a contract. And he calls me and he said, I know you want to serve your country, but why don't you come out here and start a new life? Talk to my sponsor about it. You know, they say don't make a lot of big changes in your first year. Trying to build that foundation. Well, Stockton, the part that I came from wasn't too nice. And my sponsor said, maybe it might be a good thing that you actually go there where you have an opportunity waiting for you. And you just try it out. If you don't like it, you could always come back home. So you know what, you're right. So I came out here. And I went dry. I went dry for about 9 months because I came into the oil field right when the boom was happening. And God only kept me sober. God keeps me sober every day. I want to say that this isn't me. This is God every single day. But in those times that I was dry, it was only him. Because it's a miracle I stayed sober out there in the oil field. I don't know if you guys have heard any stories, but it's not the cleanest place. And I'm not talking just about dirt. It's a pretty scary environment. And I got dry, and I finally came out of that. The boom started going down about January, February, and I found a new sponsor. And I realized I was falling off the wagon, and that can't happen. Because like I said, I don't have another one in me. So I found a new sponsor, and he asked me, he said, what step are you at? I was like, well, I ended with 6 and 7. You know, I was praying for my defects. And he was like, all right, well, we're starting over again. I was like, okay. I'm like, all right, understandable. Following suggestions, you know, following suggestions. You tell me to run down the street naked to stay sober, I'll do it, you know. So we start back on the steps. And in that 9 months of dry time, I'd fallen back into my old behaviors. I didn't drink or use, but the old Paul came out, and I caused a lot more wreckage that could have been avoided. And man, that second 4-step, being sober, 3 hours, and I'm just like, I'm hungry, I'm tired, I want to go home. Can we finish this another day? He's like, no, we're getting through it. Because the things you do in sobriety, now that you could actually feel, they hurt a lot more. And you realize they never would have happened if you would have been working a solid program. And if I would have stuck through and just tried finishing the steps while at home, or got a new sponsor sooner, as soon as I moved out to Texas, all of the things that it created could have been avoided. And after that second, 5th step, I got really dedicated. I got really dedicated because I realized what kind of person I could turn into without the program and without going to meetings, without staying in contact with sober people. So I picked up as many service positions as I could locally within my first year. As soon as I hit my 1-year birthday, I was like, I want a chair. I want to be on the steering committee. I was like, I'm just going to do it just like that. And I did. And I participated, and I watched the old-timers tear each other up at the steering committees. And I was like, holy shit, you guys got like 20 years and you're still batshit crazy. I was like, so at least I got something to look forward to. You know, at least I'm not going to turn into a vegetable. You know, they had some fight in them. You know, chair placement, you know. You know, that gets pretty bad. That gets pretty bad, especially at the candlelight meetings. Don't mess up the circle. Mess up the circle, chairs are going to fly, you know. And I got to learn about certain things, you know, and I got to see how people reacted outside of the meetings. And I got to see just a taste of the professional side of AA, which was hardly professional, and I loved it. But we still got stuff done, you know, and that was beautiful, which sadly only lasted a short period of time because I realized that my plate wasn't full enough working 60 hours a week and that maybe I should go back to school, which was a genius idea. And, you know, alcoholics, it's a do or die, you know. If my plate ain't too full, it's empty. And so I pick up classes and I ask someone to sub in for me until next rotation, you know, and have them take over the spot. And I used to love chairing. I chaired a 12 and 12 for a good few months, and that was just an awesome experience. I think that's what I miss the most because it was just fun. It's just fun breaking everything down, hearing other people's opinions, you know, because I always thought my opinion was fact, you know, my opinion was number one. Then hearing other perspectives, especially from people with a lot more time than me, kind of opened my eyes a little bit, you know, kind of made me realize that I'm still a dumbass and I don't know anything, which is awesome because I realized ego will kill you in this program. It's sad to say, but I'm one of the only young persons in Odessa. I've tried to do my outreach. You know, I've gone to treatment centers, tried to tell these guys there's a place for them after they get out. You know, and it is what it is. One thing I've learned also is I can't save anyone, only God can. But I still try. And so gets a little tough sometimes. Made me reach out, and made me go to Texipaw, made me meet Solis. You know, I realized that sometimes, even though I'm being sober, I have to reach my hand out like I need that help again. And I have to put myself out there, and I did. Even with just a touch of sobriety, I realized that just sitting here isn't going to cut it, and that I needed to get out there and put myself out there and get surrounded by other sober young people. And it's helped me so much. Back to the steps. So after doing that second fifth step, going on and constantly working on my sixth and seventh, you know, because the to me, sixth and seventh, it's like the whack-a-mole. The moles are popping up, you gotta hit them on the head. You know, that self-loathing, that selfishness, you know, that jealousy. You know, you gotta get them where they're at. And, you know, I just, I try and meet with my sponsor as often as possible. And now it's just about 10, 11, and 12. You know, that's my foundation. I feel like I thoroughly and honestly did my 12 steps. And that's all I need to focus on is my 10, 11, and 12. Because that's what it is. If I keep inventorying things on a daily basis, then I got myself covered. If I do that nightly meditation where I look back and see what I could change tomorrow, then it'll be okay. And another thing that I still find huge is, like I said, I do outreach for the young people, and that's my step 12, is that I go to Turning Point and various other rehabilitation centers, and I try and spread the message. And I know they say AA is attraction rather than promotion, but you come across my path, and you're a young person, and you tell me you drink too much, get ready to get hit with the big book, because I'm going to tell you where the solution is, you know, but that's just me. I mean, because I love the shit out of this program. It saved me from a helpless state of body and mind. And I was helpless. And I was dying. And, you know, that's a big thing to me is just getting out there and trying to get as many people as we can in these rooms, because a lot of people need this program, but they don't want it. And that's what I'm mainly trying to focus on now. Besides from attending meetings and helping out the newcomers and stuff like that, I really try and make it known that there is a safe place for people like us, because not many people know about it. And Odessa is a mixing pot because of the oil field. You have people from all over the country that came there, just like the gold rush, trying to figure out what's going on, and now they found the bottom of the bottle, because their dreams of gold turned into dust, you know, and it's sad. And we've actually seen attendance rise because of it. So, now onto my hope. Like Solis said, these past couple weeks have been hard. Recently, as in exactly a week ago, my aunt was killed in a murder-suicide.
Oh, jeez.
And I was asked by the immediate family to go clean it up. Because in Odessa, we're not a metropolitan area. They don't have the specialists like they do in places like here, Austin. That was their closest team was here. And they said it's going to take 5 hours. And it happened at 1 a.m. I got the call at 2 a.m. because I was the only immediate family that was in town. Everybody else had either gone to see their other side of the family, and my uncle was in South Africa. And so I remember getting that call. And just for a second, it felt like time stopped. And all the hairs stood up on the back of my head, because I had just seen her 2 days ago. She was just there. And I'm half Filipino. She's from the white side. But still, Filipinos, no matter what color you are, no matter what size, we're gonna love you to death. And family is everything to us. Even if you're not blood, you're still family. I mean, I got so many damn aunties, I don't even know where they come from. And they all got different last names. I'm just like, okay, but all right, you're my aunt. So, I mean, I took this quite hard because, you know, family to me is everything, especially now that I'm sober, because it used to not be that way. they used to call and I wouldn't want to pick up because I'm too busy getting drunk on that white powder, you know, or I'm too blacked out from a fit, you know, and that's just how it was. But now I want to be there for them and I want to love them because I have the ability to love now, and it's an awesome feeling. And so when I got that call, like I said, time stopped, and instantly it turned into, what can I do? Where do I need to go? Who do you need me to talk to? Where do I have to be? And she said, you know, just try and figure out where your uncle is. So I'm over here calling all these hotels, trying to get a hold of them. Finally, by a miracle, we find out the hotel he's at, not picking up. They send a bellboy up. Okay, that's taken care of. What do you need me to do now? She's like, okay, try and get some sleep for the night. I don't know about you guys, but after hearing that one of your closest relatives just got killed, you're not going to sleep at night. I went to my cousin's house. I stayed with her. I told her about it. And I'm glad I did that because there's no way I was going to be able to make it out alone for that first night. And she went to work the next day, and I couldn't sleep. I probably got about 30 minutes, and I get the call Saturday at about 8 in the morning. About 6 hours after it happened, 7. And he said, John's really distraught, the father. Can you go there with the family friend and clean it up? And I said, okay, because that's why I'm here. You know, that's why I'm sober, is because I could be accountable. I could be there. I could be there for the family, and that's what I needed to do. And as alcoholics, like I said, if the plate's not too full, it's empty. And I got to tell you, on this one, I bit off way too much. I bit off way more than I could chew. Because those things that I saw are going to the grave with me. No matter how much I inventory it, no matter how much I pray about it, they're stuck with me for the rest of my life, you know. And I did it. And I stayed sober. I didn't drink, I didn't drug, I didn't have the smallest inkling of wanting to change my perception on reality, because I knew that that's not right. That's not what I'm here today to do. I'm here to be sober, and I'm here to spread a message. You know, that's the mission. That's what we're supposed to do. And, you know, it's been tough. It's been tough. Finals are 5 days away. I've carried all A's for the first time in my life, which is amazing, which is a miracle in itself. That's how you know it's God and ain't me, because Paul doesn't get A's. Paul doesn't get A's ever. Paul graduates high school with a 1.6, which, yeah, you could actually do it. You could pull it off. Yeah. it's just been tough. It's been a tough time. And I realized that there's different phases to mourning. And, you know, I just got out of the shock. And now it's time to mourn, you know. But I know this is what my Aunt Monica would have wanted me to do. She would want me here tonight to spread my message. And this is my first time speaking, too. So I thought, hey, why not, you know. This is just a beautiful life. I was talking to a newcomer I took out to dinner last night. I said, if someone would give me $1 billion to take that drink, I wouldn't, because this is priceless. This is priceless. And I told him, too, if they would have given me $1 billion after I took the drink, I'd probably be dead within, like, 24 hours. Alcoholic with that much money? Active? No. No. You ain't going to last that long. But this is just, it's an awesome life, and I wouldn't give it up for anything. Anything. And I realized that because I built a solid foundation and I worked an honest 12 steps, that I was able to stay sober through these events, and that there's going to become harder times. There's going to be more death. There's going to be more disease. But as long as I just stick to working these steps and try and help the next person who reaches out, then I'll be okay. And sometimes I don't need to be good. I don't need to be fabulous. I don't have to be perfect. I just have to be okay. You know, and that's awesome in itself. And again, I just want to thank you guys for having me share.